Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, December 12, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the American Bar Association's new Rule 8.4 on professional misconduct. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And today we welcome our expert, Professor Eugene Volokh, who is the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh will get us started with opening remarks. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for audience questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Eugene. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure to do one of these teleforums. I am going to be speaking today about the ABA Rule 8.4, having to do with lawyer behavior and discrimination and harassment by lawyers. The ABA has adopted a new proposed such rule for the Model Rules of Professional Conduct. Obviously, that itself does not have the force of law, but those rules have historically been quite influential with state bars and state supreme courts that have often implemented them as legal rules for their states. I want to argue that this new proposal should not be implemented that way, and I'm going to talk about three problems with it. The first problem is that I think it essentially would require it would adopt a nationwide speech code for lawyers, where a wide range of expression that challenges orthodoxy on matters such as race, sex, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, and gender identity, and the like, would essentially lead to the risk that somebody would lose their license or at least be suspended from the practice of law. That, I think, is unconstitutional and, of course, a very bad idea. Second problem more broadly is I think that this improperly puts bar associations in the business of setting up employment law for lawyers, and I think that's a mistake. I think that should be left to the legislatures. And the third problem has to do with the inclusion of socioeconomic status as one of the prohibited categories for discrimination. And more broadly, it looks like the ABA's view is if a little bit of anti-discrimination rules is good, then more is better. And I think that's often a mistake, and it is so here. Let me begin with free speech problems. Rule 8.4 has long restricted certain kinds of conduct that are prejudicial to the administration of justice, and that would end up including things like saying racist things to witnesses and depositions in such in a way that interferes with the truth-finding, justice-seeking process. But the proposed Rule 8.4 would deliberately extend that to, quote, bar association business and social activities in connection with the practice of law. So it wouldn't just apply to courtrooms, wouldn't just apply to depositions, it wouldn't even apply to law firms as workplaces, though in fact it might actually impose more restrictions on lawyers than standard employment law does. It would apply to, again, quote, bar association business or social activities in connection with the practice of law. And what would it cover? It would cover quote, harassment, close quote, which is defined to include harmful verbal conduct that manifests bias or prejudice towards others. And when people say verbal conduct, that means that they really mean speech, because that's what verbal conduct is. They're just trying to avoid free speech protections. So let me give an example. Let's say some lawyers put on a continuing legal education event that includes a debate on, say, same-sex marriage, or on whether there should be limits on immigration from Muslim countries, or on whether people should be allowed to use bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity rather than their biological sex, or on what is the cause of various problems with law enforcement and law more generally and economics with particular racial or ethnic communities. In the process, unsurprisingly, a debater on one side says something that's critical of gays or Muslims or transgender people or is perceived as racially offensive by members of some racial or ethnic group. If you're going to have a debate, you're going to have both sides, and some of the people on one side or another may say things that some people on the other side may find offensive. So you'd think that that kind of CLE event would be clearly constitutionally protected, and I think you'd be right. But the ABA seems to think that that's something that might lead to liability. Let's look at this particular event. Let's assume that the CLE participant is himself a lawyer, although this could also apply if lawyers organize the event, invite a non-lawyer, but know what the non-lawyer is likely to be saying. So the speaker has engaged in, quote, verbal conduct, close quote. He's spoken. And this conduct may be seen as, quote, manifesting bias or prejudice, close quote, towards gays, Muslims, or transgender people. Just to take an example, imagine somebody says Supreme Court same-sex marriage decisions were wrong because, in fact, homosexuality is a sin and an abomination, and gays marrying should be discouraged rather than legally allowed. Does that manifest bias or prejudice towards gays? Probably. But it's also an important part of this debate. By the way, it's a view that I don't myself support, but it's a view that has to be legally protected. Nonetheless, so it's verbal conduct that manifests bias or prejudice. Some people view such statements as, quote, harmful, close quote. There's this requirement that the speech be harmful, but of course a lot of speech is seen as harmful. It's done in an activity in connection with a practice of law. Continuing legal education events are certainly connected with the practice of law. The event could also be labeled a bar activity if it's organized through a local bar association. Now, the statement isn't about one person in particular, although it could be. You can imagine the debater saying something critical about a specific political activist or religious figure based on that person's sexual orientation, religion, or gender identity. But it's clear from looking at workplace harassment law, which this this proposed rule comments to it suggest that at least in part that law needs to be worked into the analysis of what qualifies as harassment. Workplace harassment law does not limit itself to speech said to a particular person or even said about a particular person. Speech about groups has been found to be harassment and would be therefore harassment here. Indeed, one of the comments to the rule originally read that harassment includes derogatory or demeaning verbal conduct towards a person who is or perceived to be a member of one of the groups. But the italicized text, the towards a person text, not the italicized text, the text I just emphasized, towards a person, was deleted, further reaffirming that the statements that Rule 8.4 would ban don't have to be focused on any particular person. Or say you're at a lawyer social activity, like a local bar dinner, and you get into discussion, people around the table about these matters. Islam, evangelical Christianity, black and black crime, illegal immigration, differences between the sexes, same-sex marriage, restrictions on the use of bathrooms, alleged misdeeds of the 1%, cultural causes of poverty, whatever things one might talk about over dinner if the topic has shifted to politics or religion for that matter. And one of the people is offended and files a bar complaint. Again, you've engaged in verbal conduct that the bar may see as manifesting bias or prejudice and thus is harmful. Now, maybe you might think it's not biased or prejudice, but of course the whole point of the rule is to shift the decision away from you as the speaker to bar authorities. It was at a social activity in connection with the practice of law, and the state bar, if it adopts this rule, might thus discipline you for your, quote, harassment, close quote. And of course, these speech restrictions are overtly viewpoint-based. If you express pro-equality viewpoints, you're fine. If you express the contrary viewpoints, you're risking disciplinary action. And this also goes beyond existing hostile work environment harassment law under Title VII and similar state statutes. I've argued before that law itself has potential First Amendment problems, at least when applied to speech, not to a particular person, but speech to the workplace at large, or speech overheard in the lunchroom or some such. And some courts have recognized this. But in most states, the law doesn't, for example, include sexual orientation or gender identity or marital status or socioeconomic status, all categories listed in the proposed Rule 8.4. It also generally doesn't cover social activities at which coworkers aren't present. But under the proposed rule, even a solo practitioner with no employees could face discipline because of something he'd said at a law-related function. So I think that there's a very serious First Amendment problem here. The Texas AG's office was asked to issue an opinion about the constitutionality of the proposed Rule 8.4 and solicited comments. I submitted a comment. I'm sure many others did as well. So there's going to be an opinion coming out from the AG some unknown time in presumably near future. I'm glad that people are paying attention to the possible constitutional problems. The danger here is that the bar or state Supreme Court will just rubber stamp it, figure, oh, this is just the ABA doing what the ABA does best, deal with things having to do with the regulation of the bar. Well, even if it does that well in other situations, it certainly isn't doing it well here. So I hope that perhaps even people on this call might advocate with their state bars and their state Supreme Courts, if their state Supreme Court is the decision-making authority on this, to make sure that this rule is not enacted. So the first problem I mentioned is the free speech problem. The second problem is broader. It doesn't make the proposed rule unconstitutional. It just makes it a bad idea. So let's set aside harassment. Let's just focus on discrimination. It's clear that the proposed new rule would ban discrimination, not just, again, in case-related activities such as discrimination against witnesses or clients or whatever else, but also discrimination in employment, including discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status. And, you know, some people think that that's good. Some people think it's bad. And some, that is to say, to ban those kinds of discrimination. If you look at state laws, many states ban sexual orientation discrimination. Many others do not ban sexual orientation discrimination. Some ban gender identity discrimination. Many do not ban gender identity discrimination. It seems to me that whatever decision a state legislature has reached as to its employment law, as it applies to factories or as it applies to shops or as it applies to doctor's offices, it should be the same as it applies to lawyers acting as employers. Now, when lawyers act, again, as litigators, using their special power to drag people into depositions or using special access to court, it does make sense for the bar to regulate in court, in deposition activity in order to make sure that justice is done and that witnesses are not unduly badgered and the like. But when it comes to just lawyers as employers of other lawyers, but also lawyers as employers of secretaries, of computer operations people, of marketers, and whatever else, I don't see why those decisions should be made by unelected state bar authorities rather than by the legislature. If the legislature in some state has said sexual orientation discrimination is banned, well, then that state law covers that. On the other hand, if it has chosen not to ban sexual orientation discrimination, then I don't see why the state bar should impose on lawyers employment rules that are not applicable to other employers, other businesses and professionals in the state. Let me turn to the third point, which I think helps illustrate this issue well. So far, we've talked about the categories of discrimination and supposed harassment that people are most familiar with: race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity. But one of the categories, the prohibited categories that the ABA rule adds, is socioeconomic status. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct that is discrimination on the basis of, among other things, socioeconomic status. Now, the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions do not ban socioeconomic status in discrimination in employment or in public accommodations. And that's absolutely right. They're right not to ban it. And I think the ABA is just plain wrong to add socioeconomic status to categories such as race, sex, religion, the traditional non-discrimination law categories. Again, if this were limited to behavior in the litigation process, you might say, well, it's not right that witnesses be insulted because they're poor or rich, for that matter. It's an interesting and plausible point. By the way, I should mention that that there is an exception to Rule 8.4 for behavior that is kind of part of lawyer advocacy on behalf of a client. So presumably, even witnesses, you could highlight, oh, this witness was very poor and thus had an incentive to steal something, or this witness is very rich, and therefore, to the extent that the law allows you to argue this, that you shouldn't worry about whether he can afford to pay. So those things would be allowed, but other kinds of discrimination based on socioeconomic status would be banned. And that just doesn't make any sense. Let me give you four examples. First, a law firm wants to choose more educated employees, both as lawyers and as staffers, over less educated ones. Well, Socioeconomic status is not defined in Rule 8.4, but in the closest analog, in the one other area where there is a ban on socioeconomic status discrimination, the term is defined. That's the federal sentencing guideline. It's defined quite reasonably as an individual's status in society is determined by objective criteria such as education, income, and employment. So if you say we want to hire Ivy League lawyers, that is a socioeconomic status discrimination because having graduated from an Ivy League school is a form of social status. Again, the legal definition covers that, and the ordinary common sense definition covers that. The law and the rules shouldn't cover that. Whatever you might say about the wisdom of preferring Ivy League lawyers over others, that's a decision that employers should be free to make. But the proposed rule would, in fact, as I read it, ban that kind of decision. Or let's say a law firm is contracting with expert witnesses and expert consultants, and it wants to find ones who are high status. It might even send an email. Please find an associate. Please find somebody who can be an expert witness, but I want someone who's going to come across as high status. He's especially well-educated. He's had especially prestigious employment. He may be even known as the wealthiest person, especially if he's like some business consultant, the richest person in his field. All right, that's socioeconomic status discrimination. That would be forbidden. That could lead to suspension or even theoretically expulsion from the bars because it's socioeconomic status discrimination. Or let's say a solo lawyer is considering whether to team up with another solo lawyer, and he prefers a wealthier would-be partner over a poorer one. For example, he wants a partner who'd have the resources to weather economic hard times and help the firm do the same. Maybe the solo lawyer prefers a poorer would-be partner because he thinks that he wants somebody who's hungry, who's not going to rest on his laurels, who's going to be someone who's going to really hustle to get clients. Both of those decisions would be forbidden by the proposed Rule 8.4. Again, if the state bar had just left these kinds of decisions, not the in-court or in-deposition actions, but ordinary decisions about employment, about contracting and such, to the ordinary process of employment law, it would have reached, generally speaking, the right result because, generally speaking, most legislatures, I believe all state legislatures, though there may be some exception at some city and county levels, do not prohibit socioeconomic status discrimination. And they're right not to prohibit it. They're wise in this respect in a way that the ABA was not. But if the ABA had just left employment law to organizations, legislatures that deal with employment law and have seen the arguments, both practical and moral and political, for and against various employment law rules, the ABA would have done better here. And now, I will say, I occasionally hear when I criticize the proposed rule on these grounds, people saying, oh, well, that's not what the ABA meant. Like as to the speech restrictions, well, no, the ABA doesn't mean that that legitimate debate about various issues at CLE events or at bar functions would be restricted. Or the ABA doesn't really mean that you can't prefer Ivy League associates or you can't prefer expert witnesses who are high status. Well, I don't know what it meant. I know what it said. And what it said in the face of criticisms, it was alerted to these implications of the proposed rules. And it implemented the rules despite these implications. So I'm not inclined to say, oh, yes, I'm just going to assume that all bar enforcement authorities are going to be sensible about this and that lawyers trying to figure out how to avoid possible discipline aren't going to be chilled by the possibility that the rules are going to be implemented as written. Instead, I prefer to look at the rules as they are written and to assume that they're going to be implemented as they're written and that in some situations, especially dealing with unpopular ideas or sometimes just unpopular lawyers who have earned the enmity of, for whatever reason, of the state bar, they're going to be implemented without any kind of slack being cut to lawyers, whether it comes to their unpopular speech or to their decisions about, again, hiring based on socioeconomic status and the like. So that's why I think the proposed Rule 8.4 is a bad idea and why I hope that state bars and state Supreme Courts do not actually adopt it.
Okay, thank you, Professor Volokh. Would you like to take questions from the audience now?
I would love to take questions from the audience.
Very good. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Okay, we've got two questions ready. Let's go to them now.
Professor Volokh, to your knowledge, have any states yet acted to adopt 8.4?
I do not know of any state adopting the current version of 8.4, the one that I'm criticizing. Earlier versions had been adopted, but I don't know of any state adopting the current version.
Okay, thank you.
I will say I expect that some will, simply because, again, the ABA has been influential in the past on such things, and they have adopted earlier versions. It just takes time.
Okay, we have one audience member ready to ask a question. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Let's go to the next question now.
Hi, Professor Volokh. I'm from Colorado. Thanks for your briefing. Colorado has adopted an even more stringent version of 8.4. And I guess my question is, I agree with your analysis of the problems 8.4 will incur or bring about on attorneys who might run afoul of some of the problems that you've identified. What are your recommendations as to what attorneys should do in those state bars where it has been adopted? Any suggestions?
Well, I'm looking at the Colorado 8.4. Maybe this is not the most recent version, but I don't see something in it that would try to restrict speech, especially in the context of bar association activities or social activities or business activities and such. It does say that it does forbid engaging in conduct that it exhibits or is intended to appeal to or engender bias against the person, whether that conduct is directed to other counsel, court personnel, witnesses, parties, judges, judicial officers, or any persons involved in the legal process. And if read broadly, that could pose some pretty serious problems, conduct in that exhibits bias. But note, at least that is limited to against a person, so it would be a particular person. And more importantly, it is focused on speech that is directed to any persons involved in the legal process. So that is part of the bar's regulation of the conduct of the legal process, for example, of litigation. So it mentions court personnel, witnesses, parties, and such. It wouldn't cover a CLE. It wouldn't cover a debate at a law school among where lawyers are invited and lawyers are on the panel. It wouldn't cover conversation over dinner at a bar function. So in that respect, I do think the proposed rule is unusually restrictive. But to the extent that this is implemented, to the extent Colorado rule does have problems, I think that there ought to be, I think there's room for possible lawsuits, especially if it's been enforced and there's evidence that there's a realistic risk of realistic threat of enforcement. Certainly courts have at times set aside rules of professional responsibility on the grounds that they violate the First Amendment, whether because they ban certain kinds of lawyer advertising or certain kinds of campaigning for judicial positions or what have you.
Okay, again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. We have one person currently waiting. But before we go to the caller, just one programming announcement. Our next teleforum will be tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. That call will highlight the future of religious liberties under the new administration. And we will have with us Professor Thomas Berg from the University of St. Thomas Law School and Professor Richard Garnett from the University of Notre Dame Law School. Okay, let's go to our next caller now.
Hi, Professor Volek. This is Lenore Ostrowski. I have a question for you. In examining a witness, it would very likely come up in employment law cases that they discuss or ask questions about what is called statistical discrimination. Now, I've never been quite sure of how statistical discrimination differs from any other sort of discrimination. However, I am posing that to you because if this rule, this proposed rule, includes examining witnesses on the stand, it's going to interfere to a great extent with the conduct of employment law cases, to put it mildly.
No, that's right. And I should stress again what I had mentioned initially, but may not have been clear enough. It does say that that the prohibition, quote, does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy consistent with these rules, close quote. So at least in principle, so long as it's seen as legitimate advocacy, and again, I would expect that bar associations would read it relatively broadly because advocacy is what we do, I think that this kind of questioning of a witness would be permitted under the rule, would not be prohibited by the rule. Probably even lobbying or even writing an op-ed in a newspaper, even say a legal newspaper, would be treated as legitimate advocacy if it's aimed at serving a client. But on the other hand, when we're talking about, again, debates at continuing legal education programs or conversations over dinner or things along those lines, those aren't advice or advocacy, and those could indeed be punished.
Okay, very good. Let's go to our next caller.
Professor Vlog, this is George Mead in Florida. Two questions I have. One is whether there's any sense or discussion that the harassment element is going to incorporate or import the severe pervasive line of thought in the Title VII cases, particularly in sexual harassment. And then secondly, you've talked a lot about the direct impact on a constitutional ground. I'm wondering about the indirect impact as it regards due process, right to counsel, and even in the civil context, the ability to select one's counsel to pursue one's objectives that are otherwise lawful. It seems to me that a conflict is created here under 1.7 if the lawyer in undertaking representation may be subject to discipline for the out-of-court advocacy on behalf of a client whose views are objectionable on these grounds. How is that client going to be able to exercise their rights to be represented adequately? And does that not create potential liability for, I don't know, for of all things, maybe even the ABA under a 1985 civil rights claim?
Okay, two separate questions, which let me take them in reverse order. I wouldn't worry much about this rule being applied to advocacy in court or out of court, because it does specifically say that it, quote, does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy, a close quote. And so I would say that out of court advocacy, if it's viewed as advocacy, which it often is, so again, for example, writing an op-ed on behalf of someone who's doing some lobbying, or possibly even if you're defending a client and you want to speak out to respond to what the prosecution has said or something like that, I do think that that would probably be allowed. Now, I do think there's possible risk to worry, because you never know quite how it's going to be interpreted, and if legitimate advocacy is read narrowly, either because advocacy is read narrowly, or the bar starts being very picky about what it considers legitimate, then in that case there might be a problem. But I don't think there's a smoking gun as to that, the way there is as to the other problems with the proposed rule. I should say also, I don't think the ABA is making any proposals could lead to a lawsuit against them, even if the proposals are unconstitutional. If the ABA were to make a proposal saying we should strip all criminal defendants of lawyers, that would be an awful proposal, and would be a proposal for violation of the Sixth Amendment, but they're perfectly free to to speak out in favor of that. What wouldn't be permissible is, of course, for a state to implement that. Now, turning to the first point about the severe or pervasive severity or pervasiveness requirement, yes, the hostile environment harassment law in the workplace requires that any liability be based on speech that is severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile environment. And this proposed rule conspicuously omits any such limitation. Now, I'm not sure that that limitation is that great even in the workplace harassment context, because as a practical matter, the only way that an employer can avoid liability is to restrict individual statements and not just when they aggregate up to something that's pervasive. Nonetheless, at least it makes such claims harder to bring, the proposed Rule 8.4 omits that limitation, which, and in fact, the severe or pervasive limitation is often seen, is often argued to be a saving grace of hostile environment workplace harassment law, that it doesn't allow liability based in just isolated statements, but only on statements that are either extremely severe or happen again and again, but Rule 8.4 doesn't include that. Now, I do want to note that Rule 8.4 does say that anti-harassment case law may guide application of that rule, so it may be seen as implicitly incorporating a severe or pervasive requirement. But that too is not clear. A lot is unclear about this rule. So yes, that's another possible worry with the rule, another possible reason to be concerned that it may restrict a vast range of expression of unpopular opinions.
Okay, thank you, Professor. We've got three callers waiting to ask a question. If you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Let's go to the next call.
Hi, this is Lance Kinzer, Kansas, and I had a question about whether there might be some limited potential for state legislatures to engage if they're concerned about this rule. I know normally for separation of powers issues, any kind of attorney discipline matter would be reserved to the judiciary. But in a case where a proposed rule or a rule that's been implemented goes beyond what we might traditionally think of as areas of attorney discipline and instead encroaches upon an area that's well covered by other law, like the employment law situations you were talking about, a law firm's own determination to take socioeconomic status into account. I'm wondering if in those instances it might be possible for a state legislature to act in a way that would circumvent or would perhaps set aside that portion of a disciplinary rule and actually have a shot at having that upheld to avoid kind of a separation of powers issue just because of the nature of the rule. So just kind of thinking out loud about that.
It's a great question. The answer, I think, depends on the state. There are some states that have indeed read separation of powers provisions in their state constitutions quite aggressively to say that legislature can't do certain things. I believe some states have even struck down statutory rules of evidence on the grounds that rules of evidence, being rules of legal procedure, are for the judiciary to implement. A very strange position from somebody who's familiar with federal practice, where in fact the federal rules of evidence were legislatively specified. And actually California also has an evidence code, but some states take a different view. I imagine the same thing is true with regard to the question of rules of professional conduct. Some states might say this is entirely a matter for the courts. Some states might say the legislature is just as free to regulate this aspect of the legal system as much as it is a rules of evidence and of civil procedure, which again many states do regulate. Some might say, look, you can't interfere with our regulation of conduct that is directly linked to litigation. So conduct in the courtroom or conduct in depositions, right, or conduct even in negotiations. But when it does come to just ordinary employment decisions, that's something where when the lawyer is wearing his hat as just a commercial enterprise that employs workers, that is something that would be up to the legislature. So I do think it varies from state to state. Also, my guess is the political appetite for dealing with this would vary from state to state as well.
Certainly. Thank you.
Okay, we have two people currently waiting to ask a question. Let's go to our next call now.
Hi, Professor Volokh. Thanks. When the ABA House of Delegates was considering this proposed rule, a lot of the press surrounding the debate was as if this were a long overdue move by the ABA to adopt an anti-sexual harassment rule. New York Times, for example, the headline was about no more honeys in the courtroom, for example. Times of London did the same thing. And I think when states begin to have debate about this, there's going to be some push that this is just about sexual harassment and about moving the old comment, the anti-bias and prejudice rule from the comment into the black letter rule. Do you have suggestions for if states really are going to move this into a black letter part of the rule by adopting a sub G, what are the primary things that opponents of the rule need to be concerned about? I would presume it's the pervasive conduct relating to the practice of law rather than the old language, tethering it to prejudicial to the administration of justice.
Right. I would think that that politically the best approach would be the one you just mentioned, which is to say, look, it makes sense for the state bar and for state courts to regulate conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. So if people are being disrespectful within the courtroom, judges have long restricted that. Obviously, speech is not at all free in the courtroom, and the same may apply to adjuncts to the courtroom, like depositions and the like. But when it comes to behavior at social functions, even ones related to the practice of law, when it comes to behavior at bar association functions, when it comes to even behavior in the workplace, that should be either constitutionally protected, or even if it's unprotected, should be governed by ordinary employment law. That lawyers are different from others in that they have special access to the machinery of justice. And when they're in the process of using that machinery, it makes sense that the bar would regulate it. But when all they're doing is they are being employers like anybody else, they should be regulated like anybody else. So I think that that's a good way of framing it. It's also good, I think, to point out in many states that, look, a state legislature has decided, rightly or wrongly, that discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation, marital status, socioeconomic status, is not illegal in this state. Why should there be a special rule for one particular profession that doesn't apply to other professions? And I think it's also possible to point out that whatever they might say about honey in the courtroom, in fact, the proposal goes vastly beyond that. And that can't be just an accident. It's obviously deliberate. And you can't implement a rule just because one possible application of it is legitimate. You have to ask if all the applications of it are legitimate. And then finally, I do think the socioeconomic status discrimination ban is a good way of showing how far the rule goes. Although, of course, the danger with that is that people could say, okay, fine, let's just ditch that, but keep everything else, which right. would still be pretty bad. This having been said, one thing that the election has done is it has made me realize what I should have known all along, which is the deep, deep limitations in my ability to predict political events. So I can speculate, the politically wiser move would be to do this, and that would be a political disaster. How could I possibly say that? I got everything possible wrong about my predictions about what would happen with a previous election. So did lots of other people. I think we should have a moratorium on making any confident judgments about politics in other areas, at least unless we've got documentary evidence that we got this one right.
Great.
Okay, we currently have one person waiting in the queue to ask a question. Just a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. And also available there are our podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls, which you may have missed. With that, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. This is Steve Christopher. I'm a judge here in Ohio, and we have what is called the best interest of the child standard in basically anything relating to children, such as custody, guardianship, etc. And as you may or may not know, the American College of Pediatricians has come out extremely strongly condemning the issue of transgenderism or pushing an agenda on children as to sexual identity. And my concern is with this model rule that basically we could run into a situation where we're not allowed to consider things that the medical professionals are saying is very important to the welfare of a child, or that we can't mention them in a decision or even allow expert testimony on that issue and how it may negatively impact a child. Any comment?
Well, so I think you raise a very important question, but I think it's a somewhat separate question from the one we're talking about here. The rules of what is admissible in the courtroom and what ought to be included as a basis for judicial decision are different than and should be different than the rules for what lawyers are free to say. Let's just take one relatively clear example. The Supreme Court has said, and I think quite correctly, that courts cannot make decisions based on their interpretation of theology. So they can't say, for example, oh, this person wants an exemption on, because he says he is Baptist, but he doesn't understand Baptist thinking the right way. Here is how Baptist theology really should be understood. That's impermissible. That's a kind of impermissible religious decision making by a court. It's not, I think, a basis for discipline of the judge who does this. It's just a basis for reversal, and therefore judges, I think, know that they have a duty to follow the law, and they don't say such things in their court opinions. But of course, lawyers should be perfectly free to make those arguments. By the way, lawyers maybe shouldn't be free to make those arguments in the courtroom either, because under the legal rule, they're irrelevant. But when it comes to a bar association function or when it comes to a continuing legal education program, they should be perfectly free to do that. Likewise, with regard to gender identity, you know, if there is a state law or a state rule promulgated by the state Supreme Court that says family courts may not consider this and that, then even if you think that there is great evidence that this and that is relevant, well, there are rules that make relevant evidence inadmissible and an impermissible basis for judicial decision making in some situations. One can question whether those rules are a good idea, but that's a different and difficult question often. But it seems to me that lawyers arguing about those rules, including arguing at bar association functions, at CLE events and the like, they have to be free to express various views. And if that means saying, you know, I think that people who have, I guess, gender dysphoria or some such, you know, they're mentally ill and we shouldn't accommodate them and we should treat them based on their kind of anatomical sex or their chromosomal sex, let's say, however offensive that may or may not be to some people, that should be something that a lawyer debating an issue, whether over dinner or at a formal debate, should be perfectly free to say. Again, even though the rules may vary as to the extent to which judges can consider that in their opinions.
Okay, again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Professor, we have one caller waiting. Let's go to that next call.
Professor Volek, thank you for joining us today. And I was wondering whether or not you had any insight on something that has bothered me a little bit about this rule, among other things, of course, but that's in both comment 4 and comment 5, it appears that the ABA has sort of carved out an exception, if you will, for politically correct kinds of discrimination. Comment 4 says that lawyers may engage in conduct undertaken to promote diversity and inclusion, and comment 5 says a lawyer doesn't violate the paragraph by limiting the lawyer's practice to members of underserved populations, whatever that might mean. And it seems to me that what the model rule may be doing is sort of creating this distinction between politically correct discrimination and politically incorrect discrimination, which would allow disciplinary authorities to sort of suppress that sort of politically incorrect discrimination while allowing and advancing the other. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, I think you're right in saying that, but I think all it's doing is it's ratifying the existing rules and practices that say race discrimination against non-whites is impermissible, whereas race discrimination against whites is sometimes permissible, and likewise with men and women and the like. I think that those are the decisions that have upheld those kinds of that have distinguished those kinds of discrimination, whether on constitutional or statutory grounds. I think those are bad decisions, cases like Weber and Bakke and the like, but they're out there, and it makes sense that the state bar, in applying anti-discrimination rules more broadly, it would apply them, including the existing limitations on discrimination against, again, whites and men and perhaps some other categories like that. Now, to the extent that that's applied, though, to the harassment policy, I do think that just highlights the First Amendment issue, that basically, if you really take that seriously, then it sounds like criticisms of whites as a racial group might be protected by the rule on the grounds that those criticisms are aimed at fostering diversity and inclusion, whereas criticisms of other racial groups would not be. And I think that just highlight how viewpoint-based this rule is. But I should say, I think the rule would be unconstitutional as an unconstitutional speech restriction, even if it equally banned criticism of whites and blacks and or men and women and the like, because that too would be unconstitutionally viewpoint-based. So yeah, all that it's doing here, I think it's just kind of applying this reasoning of authorizing race and sex-based affirmative action, I think that authorization was wrong at the outset, but it's unsurprising that this rule would follow that principle, even if it's a mistaken principle.
Okay, Professor, thank you for that. Currently our lines are open. I do want to give everyone an opportunity to ask a question. Again, if you want to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Professor, it looks like you have answered all the questions. Oh, we do have one last caller here. Let's go to that next call.
Yes. My question is that the concept legally of gender has not been meaningfully defined. At a meeting of the Philadelphia Bar Association on this question, I asked whether anyone in the whole group of a large group of people could stand up and define for me five genders out of the 50 that are on Facebook, and I got no one to stand up and even give me five gender definitions, although I know New York defines 31 protected classes of genders. Isn't that a fatal problem?
I don't think so, at least not a fatal problem with this rule. Actually, race is not a sharply defined category either. What constitutes religion is itself actually an unresolved issue. There's a case pending right now about a company that implemented some seminars based on some system called supposedly Onion Head. I don't know much about it, but it looks like one of those things where it has some religious-like components. It doesn't seem to be a religion the way Christianity or Islam is a religion. And there's a controversy about whether that counts as religion. So I do think there's going to be some uncertainty, some vagueness in some of these terms, and some of the vagueness is going to be clarified inevitably as a result of the of case law. And case law, not just under this rule, but under the various anti-discrimination statutes that ban, in some jurisdictions, gender identity discrimination. So I do think we have something of a sense of what constitutes gender identity discrimination. If somebody is, let's say in a standard employment context, if somebody is fired because he tries to act like a woman or present himself or herself, as you might prefer, whatever pronoun you might prefer, as a woman dressed that way, and generally appear that way to society, even though anatomically the person is male, that would be and the person is fired based on that. That would be an example of gender identity discrimination. Now, what else might or might not be covered by that is an interesting question, but I do think there's enough of a core here that is relatively clear. Now, you can debate whether gender identity discrimination should be forbidden. You can seek a better definition. Again, you can hope the courts, as they are interpreting this term in other provisions, will give it a clearer definition. But I think that the uncertainty in that term is not much of an argument against this proposal, just like the uncertainty in the terms race and religion, or ethnicity, for that matter, is not a sufficient argument against this proposal. I think there are other good arguments against this proposal, but not the supposed vagueness of gender identity.
Okay, Professor, we have one more caller.
The more the merrier.
Very good. Go ahead, caller. I'm sorry, caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. Thank you, Professor, for all you've done. I wanted to go back to one point you made. I've heard some people voice concerns that advice or advocacy, you know, to, let's say, a church or a mosque, you know, concerning, you know, a religious standard or a sexual orientation standard might run afoul of these rules. And you said that the rule does say, the paragraph does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy, but it also adds the phrase consistent with these rules. Do you think that grays it enough that it might not be enough to protect advocacy that...
You know, one can't be certain, but my sense is when you have a provision like that that says this rule does not prohibit legitimate, or this subdivision does not prohibit legitimate advice or advocacy consistent with these rules, I think it's got to mean that this subdivision doesn't prohibit it, but maybe some other rules do. So you could certainly imagine advice or advocacy that is not consistent with the rules. For example, it counsels somebody how to commit a crime. Or it is advice or advocacy that, for whatever reason, let's say, violates this person's professional obligations to some other client or something like that. So I would assume that the legitimate advice or advocacy exception would indeed be read as saying that if what you're saying is in the course of advocating for a client or advising a client, you're okay, unless it's somehow prohibited by some other rule. Can't be completely certain, to be sure, but that seems to me to be likely. I appreciate the desire to be skeptical about any kinds of new legal rules. There's always the danger that they're going to be read in ways that go far beyond the plausible reading of them, sometimes even far beyond the text. We can all come up with examples where some provision was very badly overread. But here I think there are enough things where, if properly read, that is to say, if read consistently with the text, with the best reading of the text, the rule would cause huge problems. That I didn't want to focus on readings that are somewhat less likely.
Okay, Professor, do you have time to take another call?
Of course.
Very good. Let's go to that call now.
Hi, Professor. This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you for a very interesting discussion. I missed the first couple of minutes, and maybe you addressed this, but the rule must be designed to fix something, but I don't know. Is there a big problem that this rule will cure?
Well, I think there are two problems that I think that this rule is aimed at. Probably, my guess is, and I'm not positive about the political process that produced it, but my guess is the main thing they're trying to do is they are trying to come up with a total ban on sexual orientation discrimination by law firms. in employment, even in those states that do not have such prohibitions. Of course, at the federal level, there's been calls to ban sexual orientation discrimination in employment that have not succeeded. At the state level, some have succeeded, some haven't. I think recently in Utah, actually, there was a ban on sexual orientation discrimination in employment that was implemented. But I think that people who support that kind of anti-discrimination law, lawyers who support it, don't want to wait for legislatures to do this, so they want to get it done through state bars. I think that's bad, but I do think that's part of the reason. I think another part of it is there is this broader sense out there that, you know, the legal system should be doing more to restrict speech that is seen as offensive to people based on their identities. That speech is seen as interfering with various kinds of processes, with college education, with work, with the legal system, and so on and so forth. And my sense is that to many of them, the more such restrictions, the merrier. That when they propose to ban harassment on the basis of race, sex, religion, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, and the like, propose to ban it in among other things, social, and again, they specifically say this, in social activities, bar association and business activities, then I take them at their word that must be what they're trying to ban. And when they say, oh, no, it's just about people insulting each other in courtrooms or depositions, I say, I don't believe you. Well, because if it were just about that, you would have written it that narrowly. It's unsurprising, you know, this comes from the Standing Commission on Ethics and Professional Responsibility section of Civil Rights and Social Justice. Well, there are lots of people who think social justice includes just outright forbidding expressions of opinions that they see as interfering with social justice. That's what they're trying to do here.
Well, my only response would be a one-word response, egad.
Yep. And I hope again that lots of judges and bar associations have a similar response.
Okay, Professor Volokh, I think we will let that be the last word. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you for your time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.